Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So this is the last part of the chapter called The Wheel of Birth and Death. And the next section is called Desire, Satisfaction, Dissatisfaction and Freedom. And before I go on to that, there's a diagram that I made by my own hand and that I used at a number of different retreats. And so if there's people who are artistically inclined, anybody who's artistically inclined or who has a good photocopier could make up a copy of this in a bit of a larger format and stick it up on the whiteboard or somewhere appropriate. So there's anybody who wishes to do that. Again, this is not the one and only or sort of the correct and perfect way of understanding dependent origination, but it's the format that I'm using as a sort of background and the structure for much of what I talk about in this book and what I'm presenting. So if people would like to make use of that, then that can be posted for easy reference. And also for people who are not familiar with the terminology and the even the basic ideas of it, just having the words up there, avijja sankhara vijnana namarupa salayatana pasavedana and so on, so that they roll off my tongue because I've been doing this for decades. But for other people, it's like, what comes after vijnana? It's 12? 12 links? No, I can only get 8. You sure there's 12? Yeah. So, if somebody is interested to make up a copy of that and then post it, then please do that for benefit. So, desire, satisfaction, dissatisfaction, and freedom. Perhaps a good way to illustrate this last point, talking about how we can get seriously lost, but there's the potential to wake up and to be free. Perhaps a good way to illustrate this last point is to recount my own experience. When I was 21 years old, I was already regularly filled with despair. I'd become an alcoholic by the time I was 20 and was getting to the point where I was beginning to think that freedom was really impossible. Happiness was impossible. I was thinking that maybe life was just a case of surviving ordinary human unhappiness, quote unquote, for as long as we can. Eventually we die and that's all there is. I was beginning to have that kind of feeling. It seemed that it was impossible to be genuinely free because there were always limitations. You could never fulfill all your desires. Either you didn't have enough money, or there were too many laws, too many obstacles, so freedom was impossible. So that's one short paragraph, but it covers quite a lot of my psychological landscape in my late teens and up to the age of 21. So not to go into too much detail of that, but I was generally a very optimistic, cheerful kind of a person, tend to look on the bright side, glass always at least half full, if not more than half full. So that's my personality, was generally optimistic, looking on the bright side, and those of you who live with me for some time will probably be aware of that anyhow. That's generally how my mind is. But that had taken a bit of a back seat, that optimism and positivity, there were these waves of despair and hopelessness. And I hadn't experienced that before in my life. There was always this sort of positivity and optimism looking forward and promise. And so in my late teens, sort of 19, 20 years old, there was this sort of this sinking feeling, and the way that I dealt with it to a great extent was drinking alcohol a lot. So when I was 15, 16, 17, then drinking was for fun and enjoyment and partying, and it was just a kind of pleasant distraction, and all the people that I grew up with and went to school with and was at college with, and even the people that I were around about in the countryside where I lived, there were a lot of drinking going on. I was given my first beer mug when I was 6 by my parents. I had my own, I'm not kidding, I had my own beer mug when I was 6 years old, and I had an inch of beer every Sunday at Sunday lunchtime, and my father's philosophy on this was, he's got to start sometime. I didn't object. So, so there was a lot of drinking going on, and both within the crowd of people I went to school with, and in the college where I was at university, and then also just in the, I grew up in the horse riding set in the countryside, so there's a lot of booze in the horse riding people, lots of gin and tonic in particular. Scotch and gin and tonic and beer is extremely consumed in extremely large quantities, I can say from direct experience. And that expression, ordinary human unhappiness, those of you who've studied or read much of Sigmund Freud might recognize that, but that's the end of one of his very early books and one of his most famous books, The Interpretation of Dreams. He makes this comment that the best that might, something like, I don't know what the German is, but the English translation is something like, the best that my method, my approach can do is to transform your neurotic misery into ordinary human unhappiness. And when that was, I came across that, I was introduced to that in a tutorial in the I was studying psychology and physiology. Something in me just snapped, like, no, we can do better than that. I'm not going to settle for ordinary human unhappiness. That's the most we can hope for. Like, no, I couldn't make a logical argument, particularly with the tutor I had at that time. But it was that's where that phrase comes from: ordinary human unhappiness. But something rebelled against that. That was when I was 18. By the time I got to 19 and 20, then it seemed like that was all that was possible. So I drank, and so I went from drinking for fun to just drinking to not feel, and to stop existing. And I've often mentioned how I had a kind of spiritual epiphany, a sort of, not exactly a mystical experience, but certainly a spiritual turning point here in Hemel Hempstead, of all places. Currently working its way towards being a spiritual capital of the UK, but it was not quite there yet. It got voted the ugliest town in Britain a couple of years ago. It did. We won the prize. So. Ugliest town in Britain. They had a picture of the Marlowe's, the pedestrian shopping centre, in the newspaper. Like, Hemel got the prize that year. Anyway, so at this particular friend's 21st birthday party here in Hemel, I'd drunk most of a bottle of scotch. There was lots of booze around at the party. I adopted a bottle of Teacher's Highland Cream. Those of you are familiar drinkers in this country. Teacher's Scotch whiskey. And I was about an inch and a half from the bottom. I drank about a pint of scotch, and I still hadn't got to that place where everything was good. It was just, I wasn't even particularly drunk. I was just sort of a bit fuzzy. But it's like, and I literally had the thought, this is a waste of good scotch. I've drunk a pint of scotch, and I'm just still feeling the same insecure, alienated, unhappy state. And so it was a turning point, because I realized I can't drink enough to get to that place where everything is good, where up to that point, at least there was a window where the alcohol would hit to the point where you could just sort of forget everything. And in some cultures, that when people ask, what is the purpose of drinking, why do people drink? The answer is to forget. I was speaking with someone from Russia the other day, and they said, that's why Russian people drink. Yeah. I can't speak for all Russian people, but that particular Russian person was saying, that's why we do it. Seriously, he was interviewing me for a book he was doing with a Russian journalist, he said, to forget. And so I couldn't forget anymore. So then my 21st birthday present to myself was to stop drinking and to head in the other direction. So that was my gift to myself. So I stopped drinking when I was 21, and then went traveling to Southeast Asia. So anyway, that was something I've been wrestling with since childhood, trying to figure out how we could be free when you have all these limitations, like not enough money, the force of gravity, laws, people's feelings, over and over again, there's limitations we meet here and there and everywhere. And I've been wrestling with it since I was about 11 or 12 years old, trying to figure out how. I've had this feeling that somehow we can be free. There is this possibility of freedom or perfection. But there are all these boundaries, all these limitations, all these things getting in the way that obstruct freedom. And so at that age, sort of late teens, 20 years old, it was, I was beginning to get these feelings of, oh, that was all just a stupid childish dream. That was all just not fantasy. That was all just nonsense. And so there were these waves of a very despairing feeling that was taking over. But I knew that I had to do something serious about my attitude. And so, that, as I said, my 21st birthday present to myself was to stop drinking, and also I had arranged to go traveling to Southeast Asia and to seek spiritual guidance and spiritual practice, spiritual life. So that's what, about a week after my 21st birthday, I got on a plane with 22 racehorses. Another strange part of my particular journey to the East was I traveled out with I grew up with horses, so, and I was given a free flight helping to look after these racehorses as they were being taken to race and for stud in Malaysia. So I was on a plane to Kuala Lumpur with 22 racehorses. So Malaysia takes a special place in my ancestry as well. And then I wandered around Southeast Asia until I found my way to Wat Nanachat about 4 months after I left England. So anyway, to continue. I went traveling in Southeast Asia, and along the way I was shown to a monastery in Thailand. I asked to stay there simply because I needed a place. I didn't have very much money. That's always been a feature of my background, very, very little money. At the time, as a type of hippie anarchist, I objected philosophically to organized religion and to rules of any kind. My sort of freedom, interest in freedom and that side of things led me to be a sort of hippie anarchist, dismissing government laws and organized religion and all of that. I had sort of brushed aside in my philosophical approach. I thought I would stay at the monastery for 2 or 3 days, and I needed a place to stay, and my first thought, monastery, oh dear, lots of rules. Okay, well, maybe 2 or 3 days. And that was my thought. That was in January of 1978, so 44 years ago. I knew nothing about Buddhism at that time. I'd never even read a Buddhist book. I thought that the Buddha was Chinese. The monks kindly let me stay at the monastery for a few days, telling me I'd need to shave my head if I was going to be there for more than a week. That was the standard for Wat Nanachat in those days, that if you were anybody staying there for more than a week, had to shave their head. On the first evening, I asked one of the novices, it was an Anagarika, Peter Hazel was his name, about meditation, and he gave me some instruction. I remember him saying, desire is a liar. When you desire something, it's not telling you the truth. And if we let go of our desire, then it just passes away. When I heard that, I thought, that's pretty stupid. That doesn't help me at all. I still won't get what I want. I'll still be in a state of lack, just as usual. But I also thought that since I was staying in the place, I should give it a try. All guests were on the 8 precepts, which I was surprised to learn meant that there was no supper. I'd never even heard of the precepts before walking into the monastery that day. That evening, a few minutes into the group meditation, I thought, I'm hungry. I fancy some pineapple. This is not a hint to anyone in the kitchen about pineapple. It's just a random part of the story. So it's just that I've been in Phuket, where they have a lot of very, very delicious and very cheap pineapple. So I lived on sort of one baht sticks of pineapple for a long time. Then I thought, okay, I'm hungry. That's a desire. But the novice said, let go of desire and things will be fine. So, okay, I'm aware I'm feeling hungry. It's not making it go away. So what did that letting go bit mean? A moment later, I'm still hungry. Buddhism is stupid. But after 5 or 10 minutes, my mind having been distracted by something else, I noticed that when I brought my attention back to the present, the hungry feeling had gone. A few minutes earlier, I was hungry, and I was apparently incomplete without some pineapple. 10 minutes later, I hadn't got the pineapple, but nothing was missing. Oh, I didn't get the pineapple, and nothing is missing! Exclamation mark, underlined. That was the big moment. It was like a curtain opening on the way forward to liberation. I could suddenly see what the novice had meant when he said, desire is a liar. Desire had been telling me that if I didn't get the pineapple, I would not be complete. If we believe that, we end up endlessly chasing the desired object, hoping for some kind of fulfillment. The moment came where I didn't get the pineapple and nothing was missing. It was as if a pathway had opened up in front of me and I could see what I had to do. Of course, that was the start of a long journey rather than the end of one. That happened more than 40 years ago, and it's one of the reasons why I still follow this teaching today. It's highly valuable because it speaks to the insight, the intuition, that freedom is possible. Even if the addictions are still there in the system, the heart knows deep down that freedom is possible. So that was faith at that moment arose, and that was literally January of 1978, so more than 40 years ago. So any particular questions, thoughts? Yes.
It seems that for a lot of people, they invest a lot in this becoming. That's why it's so difficult to let go. So usually things have to fall apart at least to some degree for people to be able to try this.
It helps. Yeah, as long as our fulfillment program is working, then dukkha, what dukkha? It's like being born in the deva realms. It's like you've got a constant supply of everything that every desire, everything that the desire mind latches onto. So dukkha shmukkha, there's no problem. It's when it runs out or you can't get away from that. I couldn't drink enough to get to that happy place. It's sort of, whereas as a, in 14, 15, 16, it was, partying was easy, largely. But then it sort of got narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower until there was no access to that place where everything is good. And so, and it's often, that's what one of the reasons why the heavenly messengers in Buddha Dhamma are aging, sickness, and death. And the samana, the first three are those shocks to the system that then cause us to see things differently, that we're forced to wake up and to reconsider that we can't take things for granted. So that they're heavenly messengers, even though they're shocking or unwanted, aging, sickness, death. But they are heavenly insofar as they are the things that can catalyze that change of perspective. It helps you to wake up, to not be just sort of lost in your own desire system. So we don't try and make crises, but one of the, like I was talking about Dutanga practices and life in the monastery. Life in the monastery is a slow frustration program, or a gentle, kind of an eco-friendly, sort of civilized frustration program. I think Sujita, when talking about Tibetan tradition, he said in the Tibetan tradition they have these Nundro practices of 100,000 mantras, 100,000 prostrations, 100,000 visualizations. That in Theravada we have 100,000 frustrations. So we use that. No, you can't. No, you can't. No, you can't. No, you can't. No, 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 not that either. So that's like a. But they're sort of very, very eco-friendly and physically undamaging and socially acceptable frustrations. And, but they that going without, not fulfilling those habitual desires, then you're meeting that mentality that says, if I just got this, then I would be happy. If I could just go to the fridge and help myself to something that I like, then I'd be happy. And then it's just holding up a mirror to that and saying, well, perhaps, but that happiness would be very short-lived. And that's and if you're just patient and you watch this feeling, then perhaps you recognize that it's just a feeling and doesn't have to be followed. And then just like it was me with that sitting in the sala, what Nanachat, all those years ago, then just that sense of, oh, that's how it works. I thought I really got to have X or Y or Z in order to be happy. It wasn't true. It was just that it was a feeling that was there in that moment, but it didn't have to be followed or believed in. Oh, and that was something it never crossed my mind that up until that point that you could relate to a desire or a something that seemed to be a boundary or a limit in that way. And it just really hadn't crossed my mind. And so that was that feeling of, oh, this is a whole different point of view. Aha. And so that feeling of a sort of the curtains parting. It did feel like that. That's sort of like I spent quite a lot of time on theatre stages. So it's like the curtains opening and the aisle down the middle of the theatre, you know, being there before you. It's like curtains part and there's the pathway. It's the feeling I had, and like, oh, that's the way forward. And I was a confused 21-year-old, so I didn't really have it all figured out by any means, but there was a strong intuitive sense of that's the way to go. This is the key the key to freedom. This is the key to the thing that you've been looking for all these years. Follow this and see where it goes. So that's what I decided to do. Further thoughts, questions?
Yes, I have one question. You were talking about design regarding the eating habits, and I have a special design for typical Thai foods, like spicy, and when I see them and I hard to control, and for instance, also a kind of dream like coffee. When I taste them, I don't feel so delicious, but always at a certain time during the day, I go to get. And and my question is, if I discover, recognize the pattern that I desire certain types of foods and drinks, should I stop now?
Should you?
Stop.
Well, it's good to, it's very helpful to get a perspective on that. So if you say, okay, one day, today as an experiment, whenever I get that feeling, I'll do my best to just know it as a feeling. Or like when you come to the servery and your nose tells you, ooh, Thai food today. And that to, if you've made a decision, okay, today I'm just going to do what I can to notice those feelings without following them, then you can use that as an opportunity to explore that. So it's not the problem isn't the food or the coffee. the issue is the mind's habit. Like, I've got to have this. So this is a good thing. And all of us, regardless of our background, where we grew up, the kind of food that we ate as children, the mind literally is called imprinting. So certain flavors or smells have the association of good, home, happy, you know, mother, if you had a mother who was looking after you well, and that those, it kind of, depending on the country you grew up or the part of the country you grew up in, then it'll vary what those particular smells or tastes and textures are. And so it's helpful to get a perspective on that, to realize that this isn't in itself so good or delicious or it's not the happiness isn't in the food or the drink, but rather to get to know that conditioning, and it's so you won't make it go away. Like Marmite tastes good to me because in Britain often the first food that you have as a child after you're weaned is Marmite on pieces of bread called Marmite soldiers. So a large proportion of children in this country get habituated to the taste of Marmite when we're babies, and so it becomes associated with happiness, with mother, with goodness, with not being hungry. And so people who don't come from this country, they often will take some Marmite and go, "Do you eat this on purpose? Is it supposed to taste like this?" Yeah. But because of the conditioning that we have in this country, then it's the taste of goodness and happiness. It was only invented around the time of the First World War as a way to get vitamins into the diet of the people in the British Army, and they used the dregs of the beer brewing process, the kind of all the sludge in the bottom of the beer barrels was used to make Marmite, because they were looking for any kind of nutrition they could get that would support the thousands and thousands of troops in the war. And so Marmite got invented. And then, in case you're interested in the history of Marmite, probably not. But so that then that became something that was very, very popular, very widespread. And so it's that people in this country get imprinted on that. So growing up in Thailand, you know, things being spicy, having chili in Thailand, or in Southeast Asia generally, I think in South Asia, then that can similarly be the taste of goodness. And even, well, in Europe might be perceived as really kind of rich, tasty food. It's, I'm not criticizing Thai people, but I've been around Thai people when having what, and to a European or a British tongue would say, "Wow, that's really, really rich, tasty," and then for a Thai person, "Oh, no flavor, because there's no chili in it. It's not, hasn't got that hot, spicy quality. No flavor." This is like kind of to me, it'd be like kind of exploding with flavor, but that it didn't have that hot quality. So it's like, "Nah, mummy wrote, no flavor." And so to get to know how the mind is and is conditioned is really, really helpful. And things that we call bad and wrong, that, you know, something's, you know, a bad smell or it kind of tastes awful or it's really ugly, to see, well, those things are also, they're conditioned and formed because of our experiences. And that if we can get a perspective on that, so if every so often, you know, living with something that you think is a really ugly color, I say, "Well, why do I call that ugly? Why, you know, I say, oh, that's horrible. Why do I call that horrible?" And so rather than sort of getting rid of it or giving it away, you know, just keep it around for a little while, and to see that you looking at that, "Oh, this is horrible. This is ugly," and so you're not trying to torture yourself or make life difficult. "Oh, I'm attached to spicy food, therefore I should never have chili ever again." That would be too extreme, because the problem's not the chili. It's the mind's attachment, saying, "Oh, this is good, and if it doesn't have this, then it's not good." And then if we develop a perspective in that way on what the mind is accustomed to or is habituated to, then it makes us far more adaptable. We can happily live in many different situations, whether it's spicy food or not spicy food. Or
what should I get a perspective? Yeah. I don't really get the deep meaning behind, like, if I recognize that I'm addicted to certain tests, and then I recognize that it's the mind's
Well, to recognize what the mind is doing, that how when you are close to that, or you're helping yourself to some food, notice how the mind is saying, "This is my mind calling it good, and this is something that's absolutely good." Also, to notice, like, if you're feeling ill, You know, when you're ill and in any kind of food, it's like, oof, it's off-putting. To notice that, it's like, and someone says to you, that, you know, if you're ill one day, and someone says, oh, can we bring you any food? You go, oh, no, I don't want anything. Then notice, aha. So you deliberately bring that to mind, aha. So today, what I would call delicious yesterday is not attractive or interesting at all. I don't even want to see it or think about it. Look at that. So is the happiness, is the goodness in the food, or is it in the mind? So you're using that those habits as a support that quality of pijarana, wise reflection. Okay. So the next chapter is called A Buddha in Every Realm, chapter 3. In the Buddhist tradition, the triple gem, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, forms the centerpiece of our faith and practice. We reflect upon the qualities of these three jewels daily. For example, in the morning and the evening chanting at our monasteries, we recite the attributes of each of them in a formal way, but we also reflect that the elements of the triple gem have both an internal and an external aspect to them. This is called the inner and outer qualities of the triple gem. When we chant our praises, our respect and reverence of the Buddha, this refers in the external sense to Gautama Buddha, our teacher, the founder of this religious tradition, the great master who established this amazing array of teachings and who realized full and complete enlightenment, and who has been a great example and mentor of so many generations of us that have followed after. This is an important aspect of the triple gem. Ajahn Chah and other forest Ajahns would emphasize that, on a psychological level, the Buddha refuge is not so much an external historical Buddha who passed away 2,563 years ago, but rather the internal quality of Buddha. That is the true refuge. That's the safe place here and now. A genuine refuge has to be a sanctuary here and now, a memory or an idea of a historical figure, a statue, or a shrine, is not a safe place. It's an image. It can inspire, but it's not where genuine psychological, spiritual security can be found. The word Buddha literally means the one who is awake, essentially the quality of wakefulness. To, quote, take refuge in Buddha, unquote, is to choose to be awake. It is the choice to embody that very awareness, that knowing, that is the essence of true wisdom. It's an attribute of this heart, your heart, my heart, here and now. So on the internal level, taking refuge in the Buddha is to be aware, to be awake, to employ that quality of awareness, to know the flow of experience here and now. So it's related to what I was saying yesterday, that dialogue between the Buddha and the Brahmin Dona, Bhutoti Mang Pramana Dareti, you know, hold me to be one who is awake. So that quality of Buddha, also Lumpur Sumedha talks very frequently about this in his Dhamma teachings, and so that's a common theme, a regular theme within Lumpur Cha's teachings in particular. He would say, the Buddha who is a refuge, he hasn't gone anywhere. The Buddha is alive today. Actually, I think one of the last Sunday talks last summer was, is the Buddha alive today? And I quoted a lot of Lumpur Cha's comments and teachings about that. The Buddha, that is the awake, aware quality of the heart, is very much alive here today. And not as though there's a sort of... the spirit of Gautama Buddha is floating around and occupying different people. It's not that at all, but rather that quality of awakened awareness that the Lord Buddha was the embodiment of, that is an attribute of our own being, our own citta, that can be accessed, that can be used, and can be a basis for experience here and now. Any questions? Thoughts? Yes.
Have
I've got a question about when we practice the Buddha, is that essentially, I don't know enough about the Pali language to understand what's happening, but my understanding from when Samedo is talking is that it's being the knowing. And so is that essentially what we're trying to do when we're, so for example, when I'm doing breathing meditation or walking, like Buddha, and so I'm just wondering if that's reference to this idea of Buddha nature and being the knowing, and why does it go from Buddha to Buddha? So it's more about the language, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly it, really. That being the knowing is again a very familiar phrase. Lompo Sumedho would use that a lot in his teaching, and in the practice of that, rather than here is me trying to be the knowing, to recognize, oh, there is this me trying to be the knowing. That's what's happening. But there's the knowing of that me trying to be something is also it's a more fundamental kind of a knowing of, look, there's a me who's arising to be doing the practice and so on. So that in essence, the mind stays as close to that back wall of knowing, if you can use that language, as possible. Oh, I'm really getting the hang of this. And to be aware of, well, here's the mind saying, I'm really getting the hang of this. There's a knowing of that thought arising. And that, oh, I just saw that thought. That's great. I'm really getting the hang of this and seeing that. So that how the mind continually latches on to its thoughts, its judgments, its motivations, its assessments, and sort of leaves that back wall of pure awareness. And that the more that sort of, if that is a useful simile, the more that the mind can recognize that habit of leaving the back wall or that ground of awareness and getting born into sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, activity, decision making, and so on, and can embody that quality of awareness in an ongoing way, then there's there's an attunement to the time, the place, the situation. And the question Sister Tanavijaya, who's not here today, was asking the other day about, well, can that kind of watching or that being that aware one who knows, can that be a sort of dissociation or a dislocation, a disconnection? It can if it's handled incorrectly. But if that quality is developed in the most sort of complete and skillful way, then the partner of that awareness is action and speech that's totally in tune with the time, the place, the situation. So when it's time to speak up, you speak up. When it's time to be quiet, you can be quiet. When it's time to take action, you act. When it's time to be still, you're still. And so that's a part of what's really embodied in the life of the Buddha. It's both this supremely transcendent wisdom, totally liberated, supramundane wisdom of a fully enlightened Buddha, Sammasambuddha. But at the same time, every word that he spoke was true. Every action that he took was in tune with the time, the place, the situation. And that even if he sort of said things, or that he was sometimes criticized for things, or that things that he said had painful consequences when people misunderstood them or took them in the wrong way, then he wouldn't create suffering around it. He would say, okay, well, when I said that, what it was meant was this. So don't do this, do that. So that it wasn't as though every time that he spoke, everybody understood exactly what he meant and took it in the right way. But it's said every word that he spoke was true and well fitted to the situation he was in, every action that he took from the time of enlightenment. So it's pointing to an attunement to the material world, to the living system of other human beings, other living creatures. That's a natural result of that transcendent wisdom. So it's not spaced out or dissociated or abstracted, but rather, and this is a particular quality of the Buddha's way, and one of the aspects of it that I found incredibly, you know, inspiring and realistic is that rather than an enlightened being kind of being totally spaced out or sort of needing to be carried around on a stretcher or to be they're so enlightened they can't even feed themselves or which you know, that's sometimes states of enlightenment are represented in that way. It's what we have in the Buddha's way and the Buddhist tradition is there's a tremendous practicality and a groundedness and attunement to the material world. And so meeting someone like Lumpo Cha, he was very much sort of attuned to the world. And when I first met him, he was building a toilet. He had a cement trowel in his hand. He was doing the smoothing the cement around a toilet in the middle of the Wat Pa Pong. Of course, I thought, this is very significant. It's very grounded, earthy. You know. But in a way, it's true that there was a tremendous practicality and straightforwardness. And for being around someone like Lumpo Cha is incredibly good at reading people and situations. He's very incredibly observant, like he would just notice so what's going on and where people were at and what would be useful to say to each person. So like extraordinary degree of being observant and attuned to situations. Okay. When we think of the jewel of the Dhamma, we often think this refers solely to the Buddha's wisdom. The words of the scriptures and the many wonderful descriptions and skillful means that are given in the verbal teachings of the Buddha, or in the words of the great teachers over the centuries. The word Dhamma, however, literally means that which upholds or that which supports, that which integrates, so that the root of it in Pali and Sanskrit is dhr, dhr, which I'm not pronouncing very well. But close?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So it's that means that which supports or upholds, integrates, and so also like dhareti, like the I hold me to be the one who is awakened, or sila tara, the tara, is all related to that dr root. Excuse me. So the word Dhamma also means nature or the natural order. The Pali word Dhammajati, born of the Dhamma, is the word used in the Thai language to refer to nature, Tamachat. Tamachat, Jati, born of the Dhamma. The natural order of things. On an external level, taking refuge in Dhamma means that we are guided by the Buddha's teachings, taking those teachings to be a reliable source of knowledge. On the internal level, taking refuge in Dhamma is choosing to be in harmony with the way things are, to be in harmony with nature. Essentially, it means to choose to live in a way centered on nature rather than centered on our ego, our personality. So I like to phrase that having a Dhamma-centered perspective rather than a self-centered perspective, which is, and I think in the morning reflection today, I think I was talking about that. So that's that change of attitude or change of view is essentially part of taking refuge in Dhamma, letting go of the habits of a self-centered perspective, like I feel, I think, you know, my body, my personality, my life, and taking those me and mine, I structures as something absolute and solid and dependable and seeing this life and this field of experience in terms of nature, and the main way of the on a moment-to-moment basis of taking refuge in Dhamma is letting go of the self-centered habits, I making and mind making, and to train the attitude, train the heart to see and know things in terms of Dhamma instead, in terms of nature and the natural order. Taking refuge in Dhamma means that the heart attunes itself to and is in harmony with its own nature, which is also the nature of all things. As Ajahn Chah said, everything is Dhamma, Dhamma is nature. If we realize the Dhamma, then we will likewise be the Buddha. That's in the Collected Teachings of Ajahn Chah, page 485. So I like to encourage that as a way of reflecting, particularly developing the insight into not-self. So we think, oh, this is my body, or this is my mind, or these I have memories that, you know, I remember that party in Hemel Hempstead in 1976 or 77, where that was. You know, you don't remember that. Probably none of you were there. Pretty sure no one here was there. So I remember that. It's my memory, I remember. And then each one of us has got our own particular memories, our own ideas, our own feelings, and that seems to be very much who and what we are. But when that's explored and investigated, then every aspect of this body, every molecule, every atom is part of the natural order. None of us invented the proton or the electron. We didn't. No one here was responsible for coming up with gravity. Right? We didn't invent the physical world. It's not personal. And these bodies are made up of molecules, atoms, and subatomic particles. That's our body, and we say, this is me, but the entire fabric of this body is made up of these atoms, molecules, particles that are part of the natural order that you've conjured up in supernovae, great bursts of explosions in the cosmos, different parts of eons past. That's where these bodies come from, all of the oxygen and phosphorus and carbon and nitrogen. Yeah. This planet didn't exist more than 4 billion years ago. So we forget that what we take to be so personal, this body, as something who and what we are, but it's fabricated from aspects of the material form of the universe. And then we look at memories or ideas, emotions, mental attributes, moods, thoughts, and I think, I remember, this is my memory, this is my idea, my mind, my mood, but that, again, I didn't invent sadness, I didn't invent excitement, I didn't invent the ability to remember or to imagine. These are all parts of nature. And so we take those memories or those feelings, those moods, as very personal. You know, I'm feeling this, or it's my responsibility, I'm worried about it. And yet, every single aspect of our mental and physical world, when it's explored, there's not one single thing that can be found that's not a part of the natural order. Say, oh, well, my glasses, they were made in a factory. They were the factory. The people who work in the factory, the people who started the factory, the materials that the glasses are made of, where do they come from? They're also star stuff, like these bodies. The human beings that put these glasses together or printed this book, put this chair together. The beings and the thoughts, the energies that put all these objects together, and the ingenuity that arose to figure out how to make these glasses so they're the prescription that match my eyes, those are all aspects of nature. So I find this a really helpful, liberating kind of way to cultivate the insight into not-self, because with the principle of anatta, not self, you're not trying to make the mind believe that I don't exist, but it's just changing that perspective from that the way that it personalizes everything, my body, my mind, my thoughts, my feelings, my moods, my aspirations, my regrets, and to see that every single aspect of that, sort of coarse and subtle, inside outside, every single aspect of it has to be a part of the natural order. We take it very personally, but when it's sort of teased apart, when it's looked at, then of course all of it is dhammacitti. It's born of the Dhamma. It's part of the natural order. So, and then as I've been saying in the morning reflections, the point is not just to sort of repeat that as an intellectual exercise, but to realize the effect that has when there's like, oh, that's this body, this blood, these things that seem to be so much me and mine. Oh, look at that. It's part of the natural order. And just seeing that in that moment, how the mind can hold things less personally, and really appreciating that change of view, that shift of perspective. So let's go on to the taking of refuge in the Sangha also has inner and outer aspects. Externally, this is choosing to be guided by and to take as an example those beings who have awakened to the truth, to Dhamma, and who are the enlightened disciples of the Buddha. In our daily recollections, we refer to, quote, the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, which many people coming into the, when we used to do pujas, would think, who are these four pairs of people? Who are they? Have I met them? You know, are they? What is that? So the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, that refers to the four stages of enlightenment, stream entry, once returner, non-returner, arahant, and the four pairs refers to the two stages of each of those, so that being on the path to stream entry and then having realized the fruit of stream entry, on the path to being a once returner and the fruit of being a once returner, on the path to non-returner and then having reached realized the fruit of non-returner, and then on the path to arahantship and then realizing the fruit of arahantship. So this is called Magga, path, and pala, being fruit. You can think of it as a series of four orchards, if you like. If you want a mental image, just one orchard after another. On the pathway to that first orchard, then you get the fruit. Pathway to the next orchard. Then. If you want a simple representation of that. So that's who the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, refers to. The internal aspect of Sangha is about how we practice, how that noble heart manifests in the world. Refuge in Sangha, quote-unquote, internally, can mean a variety of things, but since the description of the Sangha refuge lists the qualities of goodness, respecting and loving the good, supatipanno, those who practice in a good way, ujupatipanno, loving to act in a straightforward way, uju means straightforward, nyayapatipanno, those who love to act in a well-integrated way, and how to be accomplished in goodness, samichi patipanno. I feel that the most accurate and helpful way of understanding it is to take refuge in Sangha as choosing to listen to the voice in the heart that loves the good. So that's a bit of a clunky way of expressing it, but I feel in terms of that's as an ongoing inner practice, taking refuge in Sangha is that listening to that in our own citta, which delights in wholesomeness, in kindness, in compassion, in unselfishness, in generosity, in harmlessness and honesty and such like, to listen to that in the heart which loves the good and to choose to follow that is moment by moment refuge in Sangha. So again, I acknowledge there's probably a number of other ways to interpret that, but that's what makes most sense to me. And so sometimes it can be said taking refuge in Sangha is represented by keeping the precepts it's the quality of virtue. But within that, I feel it's helpful to see that with sila, there's the sila which is the precepts, the kind of the wording of the precepts that we keep. And then there's the quality of the heart, the citta, the virtue of the heart. So the precepts, the wording of the precepts and the structure of the precepts is an external form, but the spirit of that is that the heart that loves the good, the heart that delights in harmlessness and honesty and so forth. And that inner virtue, there's a Pali word, gunadhamma, which is not very not used very much, but it represents the actual quality of virtue. So the rules themselves are sikkhapada, the precepts as they're spelt out, you know, panatipata and so on. That's the sila in the external form, but the sort of the driving force or the informing spirit of sila is that gunadhamma or that quality of virtue of the heart. Any questions, thoughts on refuge in Dhamma, refuge in Sangha?
It's about the path of fruit. And I've read somewhere, I don't know where it was, something about they arise at the same time. And maybe I've also read that maybe that's not the case. Do you have a particular understanding on whether there's a, you know, quite a significant duration between starting the path, say for stream entry and actually closing the route and the other?
I would say it varies enormously from one being to another.
So it could be an extended.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, why would you have the word path in there? I mean, path it implies there's a distance to be travelled in order to arrive at a particular destination, and so just the very existence of the word it would suggest that it's not just the same thing, but it's, you know, the, and then also I couldn't name which suttas. But there's places where the Buddha says, you know, such a being is on the path to stream entry or on the path to anagami, but they haven't realized that fruit yet. So there's places where that kind of language is used.
And would it start straight after the previous route? So let's say you get through to stream entry and then you're straight away on the path to one's return?
Or yeah, once you're out of that orchard, then that could be, it could be a long path. Yeah. So that, yeah, and I think it's good to bear in mind there's enormous individual variation, I would say. I mean, not that I'm have a direct knowledge in these areas, but how I understand these things to work, it can be it can work radically differently for different people, so that you have just like in the suttas, you have experience. There's accounts of people, you know, hearing the Dhamma for the first time, and then becoming an arahant, you know, hearing the Buddha giving a Dhamma teaching from, like, you know, Venerable Yasa. I mean, he was like a partying layman. He was staggering out one of those parties, staggering out one of those parties, having got sort of depressed and desolate. And then goes off and runs into the Buddha in the park. Well, he's still, I would suspect, not entirely sober. But he sobered up pretty quickly when he met the Buddha. And then the Buddha started talking to him and he became an arahant. But listening to the Buddha, he's still got his party clothes on. And he asked the Buddha, can I become your disciple? And he said, well, you better find some robes. And that's a paraphrase. But he's still wearing his outfit from the party when he's just sat down. So that was pretty fast. And you know, other times, you know, the situations then people practice for a long, long, long time. It's interesting that I haven't read the biography of Venerable Ajahn Mun for a long time, but if I remember correctly. He said it was a lot, many, many years between the time when he realized the level of anagami and he reached arahantship. So it was a long time, you know, like 10 or 20 years, something like that. It was a long period of time. I haven't read it for quite a while, but he makes that comment that he'd reached the realization of non-returning. And then it was a long, slow process, that last path to realize the fruit of arahantship was a long path. Yes?
According to Buddha's cosmology, are humans first born as humans, or are you start from monkey or fish first?
There isn't a first. There is no first beginning is discernible. There's a few places where the Buddha makes that comment. The no first cause is discernible, and that so there. So any human being could have come from all kinds of different places. It could have been a monkey or a fish, or it could have been a Brahma god. I don't have any abilities to see where people came from. Previous address. Previous place of residence. It can vary enormously. One of the interesting stories of the characters from the Buddha's time is Gosaka, who was a rich businessman in the city of Kosambi, and he donated the Gosita's park, which were one of the monasteries that was given to the Buddha in the Buddha's lifetime. And there's a long, long story of him starting off, way back when, as a poor farmer who's traveling through the countryside with his wife and a child, and he's not a very good dad, if I remember the story correctly. And along the way, they're starving and they're having a really difficult time. And he says, "We should kill the child and eat it, and then we can have another child later on." And the wife says, "No, that's my boy. You can't kill him and eat him." And so, fortunately, they come across a little house of some farmers, and they stay with them. And these people are very, very friendly and helpful. And they give them some food, so they, "Oh, this is great." But the husband, again, not a very good husband, he eats far too much of this porridge, and he dies of indigestion during the night. So he's like, "Oh, great food," scarfs it all down, and then dies of indigestion during the night. But because of his unskillful thoughts, there's a dog having puppies in the same building, and he gets reborn as one of the puppies. he gets born as a dog because of his unskillful thoughts. But it's a long, it really is a shaggy dog story. But then, because he did have some virtues, then as a dog, he becomes quite friendly with a Pacheka Buddha, like a lone Buddha, and becomes a protector. So he would follow along with this monk when he went on alms round in the morning, and he would keep the monkeys that would come and try and raid the monk for his food in his alms bowl. He'd keep the monkeys away, or if people were threatening his monk, yeah, he would bark at them loudly and keep them off. And he was a kind of Dhamma protector. And I had there was a dog in India that became my protector. I gave it the name Dhammapala. When I was living at Savatthi, there was a dog that used to protect me. He looked for scraps as well. He was kind of, there was some investment there. That he was not averse to the odd samosa, but he was a good dog. He was he would keep the bandar away when I was trying to do walking meditation. He would try and help me with my walking meditation too, walking just in front, a bit slower than I was walking. So anyway, Gosaka became the protector of this Pacheka Buddha as a dog. And then when the Pacheka Buddha left and went off to a different place, and the dog died of a broken heart, "Oh, my dear monk has gone away." So the dog died. But because of the virtue that the dog had created through looking after this samana, a virtuous samana, was reborn in one of the heavenly realms, went to the Tavatimsa heaven. But because of his background as a dog, and used to bark very loudly at the monkeys and such like, that deva that had been Gosaka was known as having a very loud voice. So Gosaka has a meaning of loud, loud one. And so he was a loud deva in that realm, and then got born in the human realm, and eventually, cut a long Shaggy's dog story short, eventually became was born into the human realm and became a disciple of the Buddha. And so there's an extensive account of Gosaka's story in the Dhammapada commentary, so you can find it. I also I use it in that book, The Mara and the Mangala. It appears there in some detail because it's such a great tale. But it's there in the scriptures, in the teachings, where someone starts off as a human, becomes a dog, then becomes a deva, then becomes back to the human realm, and even as an animal was able to create good karma. So that's why animals who live close to human beings can create good karma and get themselves out of the human realm. So maybe some of us were dogs in our previous lifetime, looked after a few noble beings, and managed to land in the human realm, come into contact with the Dhamma teachings. So I think that's enough for today. I'll leave it there for now.
Padakataya Sadhu Karangadama Say.
Sadhu, 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 Anumodam.
I tend to notice stories about dogs because my parents were both dog people. Along with horses, we're a dog-loving family. They appear in my world a lot.